the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
This presentation is the first one I'll be giving off of this paper that I've just finished in the last couple of weeks. The paper is Combination of Law and Technology, and it's 45 pages. So I'm actually having to cut it in half for this presentation today. So today I'll solely be discussing privacy in the cloud with regard to hackers and miscreants and those folks, and the miscreants who work for the government will be left alone for another day. Right. All right, so according to the Pew Foundation, over 69% of Americans use webmail services, store data online, or otherwise use software programs that, like word processing, that are in the cloud. This is one of those phrases that's overloaded. It's used by everyone. It's totally buzzwordified now. And I'll give you a definition in a minute as to what I mean by the cloud. But the important thing to note, and the focus of this talk, is that anyone who uses one of the mainstream commonly used cloud computing services, Google Mail, Yahoo Mail, Google Docs, Microsoft Office Live, any of those services, is at risk of identity theft and account hijacking. In many cases, there's nothing that the users can do to protect themselves. And so the focus of this talk is really going to be, why are these services vulnerable? And why have these companies failed to deploy effective solutions in the marketplace? So this is supposed to be a play in three acts, but today it'll be a play in two acts. First will be a very brief introduction to cloud computing, and then I'm going to focus on the failure of cloud providers to effectively protect their customers. Okay, so there are many, many definitions of cloud computing. The one that I'm focusing on specifically today is services where the data, the customer's data, is stored online on a company's server, and the application is delivered to the customer over the network and executed in a web browser. So we have Google Docs, we have Adobe's Photoshop Express, we have many, many different tools. Amazon's S3, and any of Amazon's other services, while they do run in data centers, are not pertinent to this talk. So specifically, applications running in a web browser where the data is stored online. So why are companies going to these kinds of services? There are many, many advantages. The biggest one is that actually it eliminates piracy. So there are no pirated copies of Google Mail running on data centers anywhere other than Google's, right? This is something, you know, when Microsoft delivers Microsoft Office Live, they don't have to worry about people in China running bootleg copies. Now, right now, they're giving away these products for free, but that can change down the road. And the important thing is that they can lock down the services whenever they need to as well. So if someone abuses the system, or they just decide that they don't want to offer service to a specific country anymore, they can very easily terminate access. For systems like Adobe's, where there are valuable patented image mangling algorithms, they don't have to deliver the algorithm itself to the customer, right? So the algorithm can run on a remote server, the customer submits their image to Adobe, Adobe manipulates the image and then hands it back, and that severely reduces the ability of competitors to reverse engineer their products. So you get some IP protection there, you get targeted advertising, and that your customer's data essentially resides on your servers, or the service provider's servers, which means they can go through it and see what the customer's doing and what kind of ads to show to them. And finally, a very, very crucial benefit for companies like Microsoft that have in the past been slammed for poor security, when you deploy a tool via the cloud, your customers always run the latest version of the tool. I'm sure, you know, any of us in this room, you know, if we're using Gmail or we're using Yahoo Mail or Microsoft Hotmail, we have no idea what version number of the programs we're running. We just go to their site and it downloads the latest version of the JavaScript from those companies and executes in our browser. We don't have to worry about upgrading, and so those companies don't have to worry about users using old versions of their software. Now, what about for consumers? So the first benefit, of course, is the price. These services are free. The traditional services in word processing and spreadsheets cost money, and so there's a strong incentive for customers to shift over to these. The second benefit is automatic revision control or backups. So you use Google Docs and all your files are backed up automatically for you. You can share them with your friends and family. They can make edits. You can make edits. You can revert the edits. You can log into a computer in a cyber cafe in Beijing and pull up your documents. There are all these benefits. It's great. And so because there are benefits for consumers and because there are benefits for the suppliers, we're starting to see these services increasingly being used. And in some cases, consumers don't really know that this is happening. So Asus, which makes my little laptop, and several other providers or manufacturers of low-end PCs are now shipping machines primarily based with the Linux operating system with icons for cloud computing services on the desktop. So rather than shipping with a copy of Microsoft Word or Microsoft Excel, they ship with an icon for Google Docs or Google Spreadsheets. And the obvious advantage here is that they don't have to spend $50 to $75 for a license for the user. Right, and these machines, they have 3G modems built in, they have Wi-Fi cards and Bluetooth, so the user is expecting to be online all the time. But this actually isn't such a bad assumption, and it really does drive the cost down. Universities are now switching to Gmail, and to a lesser extent to Microsoft's tools, and so students arrive and they get the Gmail interface, but it's branded with the university's own logos and that sort of thing, and the students get to use the harvard.edu or indiana.edu email address, but their email and all of their data resides on Google servers. The new federal CIO, before he joined the federal government, switched 38,000 Washington, D.C. employees over to Google Docs, again in an attempt to save money. And it's unclear what he's going to do in his new position, but it's fairly obvious that he is Google crazy, as are several other members of the Obama administration. And so we're likely going to see a continuing shift in that direction. Now, many of the people in this room and many people with technical skills might realize they're using a Google tool or a Yahoo tool or a Microsoft tool. But many less technically savvy users, especially those who are using the tools provided to them by their employers or by their universities, may not realize that they're shifting to the cloud. Right? They sit down at a desk, they double-click on the icon on the desktop that looks like a pen and paper, and they start writing a document. And from their perspective, it's seamless, right? They don't have to log in many cases. They don't have to worry about anything other than just typing their document. And so there are several technologies that I'm going to go into now that make this transition to cloud computing even more seamless. So the biggest problem for cloud computing providers for the last couple of years was the fact that when you went on an airplane or went anywhere without internet access, you lost access to your documents, right? This was a huge problem. But this was solved in 2008. Google released its Gears product, which basically provided offline SQL database access to the web browser so that its own websites, Gmail, Docs, Spreadsheets, and a few others, could provide offline functionality. So you really can now get on an airplane and create emails, access your most recent emails, and then the moment you get off the plane and have internet access again, it synchronizes and all your email gets sent. It's fantastic. Several other companies, including MySpace, have leveraged the Google Gears API. And then in the last few months, finally, we're seeing similar technology deployed in mainstream web browsers. So the latest version of Firefox, which is 3.5, that's going to be coming out really soon. The betas are already out there. That supports offline SQL access by default. So you no longer need Google Gears if Google actually embraces this technology. Safari has this. I think Opera has this. And who knows when Microsoft will adopt it. But this technology is out there. And what had previously been an issue of offline access is now no longer a problem. An even more interesting technology that's on the horizon is this concept of a single site browser. So traditionally, we do all of our stuff via one browser, right? So we check our email, we do our online finances, we waste our time when we should be studying. We do all these things via one interface. And it turns out that this is a really bad idea from a security point of view, right? Because there are websites that we trust, like our bank or our mail provider, and then there are websites that are not so nice. So providers of free screensavers and flash games and Whereas and pirated movies, right? And when you go to those nasty sides of the web, sometimes they will push malicious software upon you, and that malicious software or that malicious content can reach into your browser and look at the other things that you've been doing. So they can find out which websites you've gone to in the past, which can then help them to make a more effective phishing attack. Say they know which banks you use. They can steal your Google account information. They can steal your contact list information. I mean, in general, people in my community recommend that users actually do use one web browser for their important stuff and another web browser for their waste of time stuff. But many people, in the same way that we recommend you use different passwords for different sort of levels of service. Single site browsers make this technology really, really easy. So Mozilla, who makes Firefox, has the project called Prism that essentially allows you to make to create an icon on your desktop. You double click on it and it takes you to one page. That site is loaded, that site's information is stored in its own folder. All the cookies and browsing history are in a unique profile, which means when you visit another site with your regular browser, that information doesn't leak across. So I have a screenshot or two here. So this is the way that you create a Prism browser. So you give it a site, give it a title. Now these are all the defaults. So you can see that by default, there's no navigation bar that's shown. There's no status messages, there's no back and forward buttons, there's no navigation keys, no notification area. It doesn't look like a web browser anymore. So this is Google Docs in a Prism window, right? So I have an icon on my desktop that has the Google Docs logo. I double click on it and this window pops up. There's no back forward button. There's nothing to the user. It doesn't even say Firefox in it. There's nothing to the user that says this is happening via the internet. And I think this, more than any other technology, is really what's going to make it possible for cloud providers to be able to deliver their products seamlessly to consumers and I don't know if transparent is the right word, but without the consumer knowing that they've ever left their computer.
Chris, can I just ask a quick question?
Sure.
What happens if you click a link in a Prism environment?
It depends on how you've configured it. In many cases, it'll open a new window. But you can actually lock it down so that you can never leave that domain, or that a new window will open up in a Firefox browser or in the other browser. There are many ways to configure that. But it's a really cool technology. And so, I mean, I already use this for my online banking and for my email. And then everything else happens via the main Firefox window. All right, so the point from that section here is that cloud providers cloud-based services are increasingly being used. And in many cases, users don't realize that they have moved to the cloud. But, well, why is that a problem? These services are made by large companies that have huge staffs of PhDs who know what they're doing. They would never put their customers at risk, right? Well, it actually turns out that most of these services are vulnerable out of the box. All right, so since 1995, web browsers have had encryption technology built into them. And this technology has been widely used by online banks and e-commerce sites and health providers and gambling sites and anything where money is changing hands, encryption is now used. And in the latest versions of Firefox and IE, we now have this green colored bar over here that tells you it's a really trusted site. And researchers have spent time trying to make the security process work better for the user so that users actually know when they're visiting a safe site. Turns out that none of the cloud computing providers use SSL for much information at all. So your username and password is encrypted when you log into Facebook, and when you log into Google, and when you log into Microsoft's Hotmail system. Only your username and password. After that, all of the rest of your information goes over the network in the clear, which means that your documents, your spreadsheets, your emails, everything is sent over the wire in a way that someone with the right tools can easily sniff them. So these tools, they're called packet sniffers, are included out of the box in the Linux operating system and in the Mac operating system. And if you're a Windows user, you only have to go and download them. They're very, very easy to download and install. Now, in the years past, when I described some of these issues, I would give demos of how they ran. I know better than to do that now. But luckily, other people have done it for me. So this is the Wall of Sheep, which is something that happens at DEF CON every year, which is a big hacker conference in Las Vegas. And this is basically a packet sniffer hooked up to a projector. And these are collections of email addresses and passwords, and then the protocols that they're going over. So here we can see that there are a few Gmail accounts that have been grabbed here, some AOL instant messaging accounts, some Yahoo accounts. I mean, this is not rocket science. These are easy to set up. I have one running. I mean, I have one available on my computer. It's not running now. and the only thing that's protecting you from someone using these is the law. But people who are willing to violate the law can very easily get the information that you're sending back and forth to any of these cloud computing providers. Now, even cooler than the packet sniffer, in my humble opinion, is this tool, which is called AIMject, which allows you to intercept an instant messaging conversation and send unique messages to both sides of the conversation. So not only can you see what's being said, but you can hijack the conversation and then change the messages as they're sent live on the wire. I think this is really cool. obviously, you should only ever use this on your own network with your own computers running or the conversations happening from your own computer. But, you know, and this isn't the worst of the problems. So as I said before, SSL is not used to protect people's conversations and other information. But so the way it works when you log in, you will transmit your username and password to one of these providers via SSL. And after you've provided your information to them once, they give you back a cookie. This is called an authentication cookie. And so anytime you then ask them for information in the future, you don't send your username and password back to them. You give them this cookie. And anyone who has this cookie effectively is you from the perspective of that service provider. And this cookie is never sent in encrypted form. So if I sniff the network in this room, I can collect the cookies of anyone logged into Yahoo or Facebook or MySpace or AOL or any of these other services. I have this cookie and it's like 100 bytes of text. It's very, very little bit of information. And using this, I can log into the service as you. I can look through your old messages and files. I can modify your files. I can delete your files. And I can send new messages to your friends pretending to be you. Not only can I do this while you're sitting in the Starbucks or the room next to me, I can do it a day later or 2 days later or a week later until you click that log out button, which many, many people don't do. So this is a big deal. And the failure of these sites to protect these authentication cookies was first noted in 2007 at that same DEF CON conference. A researcher gave a talk there and said, look, this is a widespread problem throughout the industry, that this is not one company who's offending. This is totally widespread. And the main guys were told. Google was told, Microsoft was told, everyone was notified. A year later, the problems had still remained unfixed at all the main providers. And it wasn't until a week before the researcher released a tool that automated this that Google actually released a fix for their system. So Yahoo and Microsoft users are still exposed to this day. So even though Google released a fix, they didn't turn it on by default. So unless you know to dig through your configuration options in Google, which I'll show later, all of you who use Gmail are probably still exposed to this attack. So his tool is called Cookie Monster, and it effectively allows you to hijack the cloud-based accounts of users of Google services, Microsoft services, Hotmail, Yahoo, all of them. Okay. Did I say this before? Okay, so Google offers SSL. They offer encryption to their users, but they don't turn it on by default, and they don't tell their users that it's available. Whereas Microsoft and Facebook and Yahoo don't offer it at all. So if you're a user of Facebook, there is nothing that you can do to improve your security. You can lock down your profile to protect people from looking at it in your social network, or to stop your parents and your professors from looking at your information, but there is nothing at all that you can do to protect your account from being hijacked when you check your Facebook account in a Starbucks. Nothing at all. So in describing sort of their really shoddy state of security, Google wrote this blog post last year, and I love the title of it. It's Google's responses to why their security sucks so much is that they're making security easier for users in the same way that the Patriot Act protects our rights. So the keywords to note here is that so it says, we use SSL to protect your passwords every time you log in, but we don't use this same technology once you're in your mail unless you ask for it. Why not? Because the downside is that this technology can make your mail slower. Your computer has to do extra work to decrypt all this data, so that's why we leave the choice up to you. So you see, Google's nice. They're caring and sharing. They're worried that your computer will be overloaded by this encryption technology, right? They're trying to save you maybe some energy on your power bill. They're worried that your laptop might get too hot. Maybe you'll scald yourself. So what about these paternalistic other companies who don't give you this choice, who force security down your throat? So this includes all US banks, all health insurance companies, Adobe's Photoshop Express, which is another provider of cloud-based application, right? So this is like online image editing. Even the CIA, right, which has no classified information at all on their public site. This is where your kids can go and find out how the CIA works or see the CIA factbook. Every single page on the CIA's website is encrypted, yet most users to Google services get no security at all. Are there any other providers who've decided that users don't deserve any choice and that they should be forced to have encryption? Oh yeah, Google. So Google's health product, which stores your online health records, uses encryption by default. And if you try to go to the service without using encryption, it forces you over to their encrypted page. So why do they offer choice to users of their documents and spreadsheets and mail program, but not offer the choice to users of their health system? Why are they not worried that users of their health system will have such a slow and cumbersome experience? And the reason is that there are laws regarding the privacy of health information, and if Google were to transmit your health records over the network in an unencrypted way, they would be violating the law and probably inviting several lawsuits in the process. So when Google describes its products to its customers, it says, our products are safe. Upload your documents to our servers. And so if you go to the Google Docs homepage, it tells you files are stored securely online. You can trust us, right? We're big and cuddly. Now, the company does tell people about the risks of cloud computing, but they're hidden 5 layers down in a help page that's not available anywhere else on the site. And so it basically says, if you sign into Gmail using a non-secure internet connection, your account may be more vulnerable to hijacking. That's the only page on Google's entire site where this information is disclosed. If you log into Gmail, this isn't shown. This isn't shown on the main page. Everywhere else, they tout their security and benefits and how nice the system is. This is the one page where it's described.
It also has a title that's instantly recognizable to non-technical.
Right. So it gets worse. I'll show you in a minute. But so in the few places where consumers have the ability to improve their privacy and security, Google goes out of its way to obfuscate what's happening. So unless you're an Uber geek, you won't know that this is a key option. So in your Google account settings, at the very, very bottom of the page, there's this option here, which has browser connection, and it's always use HTTPS or don't always use HTTPS. That's the option. And if you haven't realized that you need to check that box to protect yourself from account hijacking, it's okay. Many other people are like you. Yes?
Maybe this is your point, but does that mean never use HTTPS or perhaps use it sometimes?
What this means, you should check that box next to always. Right? And you're a graduate student, right?
Right.
So this is a failure in user interface design. This is the last of 13 configurable options below Unicode, keyboard shortcuts, and vacation responders. So this is the least important of Google's options. You have to scroll down to the bottom of a screen and then decipher what this means to turn it on.
What do you think their motivation is in doing it this way?
Hang tight, I'll get to that.
Okay.
But it involves money. Okay, so most users of cloud-based systems, and actually most users of computers, have no idea of the risks they face when using wireless networks. There was a paper at CHI presented in Boston last month that said that, quote, despite living in a technologically sophisticated area of the US, the participants were not aware that the information sent over Wi-Fi could be seen by others. So in this study, these users took other steps to protect themselves online. They changed their passwords, they looked for the SSL icon, they went out of their way to try and be safe, but the fact that the information was being transmitted in the clear was something they didn't know at all. In another study a few years ago, researchers, I think here at Harvard, discovered that users were both unable to detect the presence of the lock icon and to notice the absence of that lock icon. So even if users realized the benefits of encryption and the benefits of SSL, in many cases they wouldn't notice when a cloud provider decided to not turn it on by default. All right, so to answer your question, why do we not have SSL by default, at least with Google? Using and processing SSL transactions consumes vastly more processing power than performing regular transactions. Right? This is not a big deal. Despite what Google says about slowing down our computers run idle 90% of the time. My cell phone can do SSL. My laptop definitely can do SSL. Now, it cannot do flash all the time, but it can definitely handle SSL. Now, Google servers, on the other hand, those are really, really overloaded. In many cases, they barely have enough processing power to handle all of the services that they offer. And so moving all their customers over to SSL or to any kind of encryption by default would lead to a significant increase in the number of computers necessary. And those data centers are not cheap. Right? It's not a case that they can even throw more money. It takes time to build a data center. And it takes months and months of secretly buying up land and whatever else they do. So not only do they have an incentive to not turn it on by default, but they have an incentive to not advertise the availability of the option in the first place. The less people who use this option, the better it is for Google. All right, so few users are aware of the risks. Providing the protection from these attacks costs the companies money. And this essentially is a fixed cost, right? So if 100% of Google's customers turn this option on, the company sees no additional profits, but they do see additional costs. And right now, they're not charging most of their customers for their product. So this is a direct hit to their bottom line. All right, but Google is one of the better ones. As much as I dislike the company, as it's clear from my talk, they're actually one of the best ones in the industry. The only company that's better in the sort of cloud computing sphere that I found is Adobe, which turns on encryption for all of their online image editing by default. There's no way to edit an image insecurely using Adobe's free Photoshop Express tool.
Why do they do that? To protect the algorithms?
No.
Why do they do it?
So the algorithms that are running...
Business people?
My suspicion is that not many people are using their service. And that, therefore, it doesn't really cost them very much money to turn it on.
So what's the relationship between how frequent the communication is between client and server? Because if email, if you have an automatic updating system, do you know how often my computer is talking to Gmail servers right now and how many different small files have to be sent?
No. But I mean, I assume the more data that's sent, the more data then has to be encrypted, and the higher the load is on their servers.
Right. But I'm saying that's if it's a protocol that is built on many, many tiny independent transactions where you can't take advantage of the stream encryption, then you sort of see, well, that first doesn't start to get a non-trivial amount of work on my machine if I'm using my machine a lot, and also an enormous amount of load on there.
So my laptop is as fast as a laptop that you would buy new maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And I suffer no performance hit from checking my mail over an encrypted connection.
But I think that what I'm curious about and what I think will help your research is unpacking what makes web services different and what can be done on their end to improve it so that instead of having many repeated, very small transactions, they can actually have a more stream-based communication that leverages the power of SSL.
So what you're saying is by enhancing the algorithms, we could reduce the cost to both the service provider and whatever the costs are to the consumer, if there are any at all.
Well, yes. So in responsiveness alone, right? So Google knows a lot about how a millisecond here and a millisecond there really does have a tangible impact on how we, the users, use their experiences. Sure. So the timing alone could be, if I'm trying to take their side. But
stop,
if you're trying,
stop it,
if
though.
You're trying
Come
to
we don't need to take their side. Come on. okay, but in any case, most companies don't offer it. I mean, Google at least offers it as a choice. And if what you're saying is true, then the company can give people a real choice, which is saying, these are the risks, you know, these are the options, here's a button that you can press to make this secure, you know, try it out and see if it's for you. But they don't do that. And most other companies don't even give consumers that choice. So there are these two researchers, I think they're both from Boston, one's at Harvard and one's at MIT, and they've written about this concept called a shrouded attribute. This is an economics paper. And I'm not going to go into the paper in full, but the idea is that there are some properties of goods that consumers fail to judge when making a purchasing decision. And the best example that they give is of inkjet printers, right? So you go to the store and you buy a printer and there's one model for $30 and one model for $150, and you instantly buy the one for $30, even though the ink is $50 a cartridge. And over the lifetime of the printer, it would be way cheaper to buy that more expensive one on day one. The same goes for free checking accounts, right? Where you pay no fees, but then you get stung for $20 every 3 weeks when you don't have enough money in the account. I've looked at their paper, and I'm starting to think that there's a very, very reasonable argument that can be made that the privacy and encryption for a cloud computing service is in many ways a shrouded attribute, right? We consider how much storage does this service offer us, or are all my friends on this social network? You know, we don't consider, am I protected from theft? Am I protected from account hijacking? And in many cases, the reason for that, I think, is that if your account is hijacked, you don't know why it happens. You're not able to identify the harm that you suffer from your account being broken into to that moment that you were sitting in Starbucks, right? There's a separation of that. So in my paper that I'll point to at the end, I go into this in depth and sort of lay out a bit more as to why I think that this is a shrouded attribute. But it's a really cool paper. I'm very excited that I found it last week. Okay, so default settings matter a lot. There has been research by economists and computer scientists and lawyers in this area. We've already found out that if employers opt their employees into 401k programs, no one opts out. You get almost 100% enrollment, whereas if people are left to opt in to the 401k savings plans, less than 50% opt in. We've seen the same thing for organ donation, and in the internet sphere, I think Facebook provides the best example of this. I mean, this is a company whose privacy problems are in the press almost on a monthly basis, yet only 20% of users have ever modified a privacy setting. So, what Facebook and Google and all these other companies do have adopted this strategy of blaming the user. So I think this quote from Ross Anderson really sums this up, which is that Facebook appears to have a strategy of dumping all the really hard security decisions on users so that they can then respond to criticism by blaming the user for not turning off feature X and Y. Right? This is what we have with Google and with Facebook. And while with the other companies, there's not even an option. But with Google and Facebook, that's definitely the case. Consumers should be given safe services by default. That's what we need. Consumers are not aware of the risks. They definitely fail to recognize the presence of SSL. And you know, companies should protect their users. Right now, they're not. They should. And so in the last couple of minutes, I'm going to explore a couple options for how we can twist the arms of these firms and get them to do the right thing. So there are two analogies I'd like to draw here. One is to cigarettes and one is to seatbelts. And I think both have pros and cons. The, you know, as as someone who's not a big fan of the government forcing technology down people's throats, I would prefer that we go down the route of cigarettes first. So that if the problem is lack of consumer awareness of these risks, then what we can do maybe is teach consumers about the risks so that then they demand appropriate solutions. If we can attach consumer education to only those products that are insecure, we can also provide a strong incentive for companies to fix their tools and thus avoid the need to add warnings. So I have two cigarette-style warnings. Both of these would be attached to the front page of Gmail, the Gmail login page. So warning, email messages that you can write can be read, intercepted, or stolen by the person sitting next to you at Starbucks. If you wish to protect yourself from this risk, click here for a secure version of our service. So this would apply to Google, which does offer an encrypted version of their service, and for users of Yahoo Mail. Warning, email messages that you write can be read, intercepted, or stolen. This service does not provide the encryption necessary. However, other free services do. Click here for a list of these. Now, obviously, the service providers wouldn't like this, but then the cigarette companies haven't been too keen on their warnings either. Finally, seatbelts. So the auto market failed to deliver safe vehicles for years, right? The problem was that seatbelts cost money, and if you didn't put seatbelts in a car, you could offer your vehicle at a lower cost and steal customers from your competitor. So finally, it took regulators and Ralph Nader to step in and get seatbelt laws passed. If advertising or if consumer education failed, I would be open to the FTC or another regulatory body getting involved. I think that given the language that Google and other companies use regarding the safety of their products and the security of their data, a very reasonable argument could be made for an unfair and deceptive business practice. I know there's already been an FTC complaint filed by Epic a month and a half ago regarding the insecurity of Google's cloud-based services. So this is definitely something that has potential. All right, in conclusion, most cloud-based services are insecure. Google services can be protected if you turn on an option that probably no one in this room has turned on. Most other providers are vulnerable to hijacking, and there's nothing that users can do about it. And the market is broken, and we desperately need a fix. Okay, questions? David.
What sort of information do we have about not the risk, but the actual rate of theft and badness that occurs with this?
So this is, in many ways, a passive crime in that the attacker can gather your username or they can gather the details necessary to break into your account without ever broadcasting any data. Now, if they just want to steal a document as it's being sent over the network, they never have to send anything at all. And otherwise, they only need to send data when they log in. So we have no data at all. I mean, this is yet another subject that Google refuses to comment on as a matter of policy. So, I mean, the tools are out there. You can download them and run them and in 5 minutes have probably 5 Gmail accounts. And I definitely wouldn't advise that you check your Gmail account from the DEF CON conference floor. Yes.
Along those lines, I checked my Facebook while you were talking. Who here has my... Anyone?
Okay, do you have a question or just a joke?
I'm curious. Is anybody actually trying it right now? They don't want to admit it.
They would be violating the law. Okay. So I would hope that they would be smart enough not to mention that. Yeah. Okay. And anyone else? Yes.
I'm curious. This is tangentially related, but what are your thoughts on OpenID as far as for security reasons and getting into people's accounts?
So OpenID is a system that allows you to leverage your existing authentication tokens from other providers, so that way you don't need to create a new username and password on this blog that you're going to leave a comment on once, and you're probably going to use the same password that you use everywhere else. The issue of the authentication cookies is the same here in that, okay, you've used OpenID to log in, now how do you communicate? You send this thing back and forth. So we need encrypted communications, or we need to use networks that we trust 100%. But that doesn't work for this paradigm where we sit down at a cafe and check our email, or where our internet service providers like AT&T and others are hostile to us and use deep packet inspection to look at what we're doing and everything else. Yes?
Your
your analogy with the seatbelts, could you think of just general car safety ratings so you, that companies can submit their tools to a regulatory body that evaluates them, and then they can advertise that we have a 4-star rating, and then consumers say, well, I want something that's 5-star rated, and the consumer then demands that these cloud computing services have higher and higher security ratings. Could something like that work, or would it be abused by the company?
I mean, that's a cool idea, and I mean, there are definitely other things that these providers could do to improve their privacy and security, and I get into that later on in the paper. But the fact is that SSL, it's just one option that you either turn on or turn off in your configuration file. You know, it's not protected by patents. There are no royalties. It's available on every open source web server. I mean, this is not a question of whose technology is better than whose others, right? This is whether they've enabled a single option and turned it on by default. So I don't know whether, you know, 1-to-5-star rating system is going to be appropriate to capture what is essentially a binary choice.
I think, you know, in terms of the activism side of what you're doing, the lack of data is going to make it hard because, you know, we don't know that there's been a single, I mean, there's more than a single case, but it's not clear. And I think an interesting parallel for you to think about is that all of these safety things, including cigarettes, including seatbelts, helmets, all these other things and stuff around the net, people tend to be much more excited when the threat is to children. So... But, I mean, seriously, I think, you know, if you're really interested in saying, you know, I don't have any data and I really want people to act, might be to target things like, you know, websites that are designed for children, under 18-year-olds using Facebook, because
right.
That seems to be where most people get really much more alert around an issue like this.
So that's really smart. I didn't think of the, oh my God, save the children angle. So the only problem with that, at least for this specific instance, is that Google's terms of service specifically prohibit anyone under the age of 18 from using any of their services.
Right,
so now they, of course, know that everyone in high school is using their search engine. But so they're able to claim, well, you know, this is not a problem because we don't have any kids using Google.
But I'm saying that in terms of trying to, on your activism side, of trying to get people interested, if the services that do aim for children, like Penguin Parks and things
right.
like that, are also putting their information at risk.
But you have to consider the worst case scenario, right? So if I'm a kid using like some online Penguin chatting system, what's the worst case scenario of me having my account hacked versus my Gmail account, which has my backup login information from my online banking getting stolen, right?
I understand what you're saying. I think it's true, but the fact is people haven't gotten excited about that. And, you know, even with the seatbelts, they didn't get that excited. I mean, the laws about seatbelts initially were only that children had to be restrained. And in most places, if you really want to ride without a seatbelt, not here in Massachusetts, you can, but you can't, children cannot. I mean, there it certainly makes sense, and I'm not saying it.
But the auto manufacturers had to at least sell cars with seatbelts though, right? Just in case a child was in the car. So
if children are giving out information on these sites, such as their address, it's one thing. We know that, okay, the site's kind of safe. They'll still make mistakes, but should the creepy guy from the school be able to sniff it?
Okay. Yes.
How much of a solution is just turning on the SSL, or is it just a temporary stopgap measure? Are you still vulnerable even if you encrypt at that level?
Yeah, it's fine. Your bank uses this, right? So your bank uses this, your credit card uses this. It would take an array of computers that maybe the NSA has to break the encryption used in SSL. So this is, you know, we're not talking about pouring millions of dollars in research and development. This is enabling an existing technology that is royalty-free and is in every web browser, right? The customer doesn't have to download any more software. It doesn't get any better than this in terms of the ease of improving consumer privacy.
Can we get to a point where servers are fast and cheap enough that the overhead for SSL won't be as much of a cost for Google and they won't really care about implementing?
I don't know, because, you know, given a choice between handling another million users or giving the existing number of users SSL, I think they're going to want to provide more services to more people or crawl more pages on the web. Or I mean, there's always something else they can use their computing power for. And right now, I think they've made this calculation that consumers don't know about this, they're not demanding this, and so therefore they're not going to waste that computing power on this cost. Yeah. Did you want to go, Alan? I was going to ignore you for a while.
Well, so I noticed that you talked about two regulatory strategies, but you didn't delve a little further into the market forces, which could be used to leverage this. And to address the question about data, it seems to me that if you were trying to pitch this, say, listen, how many private companies are using all of these for very important issues? And let's start talking about actual losses. TJX, 40 million credit card numbers lost because they were sent in the clear of a wireless. The bad guys are listening to wireless networks. They're trying to steal things. And we have an army of moderately useless security consultants out there. At least they can start telling companies, don't use these online services until they provide a decent encryption.
So you're suggesting some kind of customer boycott of Google?
Not a customer boycott, but if you're trying to do activism against companies to have them understand it's in their best interest not to use unencrypted services.
Right. So, I mean, I've been trying to tell my friends to not use Facebook for years for other reasons, and I haven't been very successful. I don't think that SSL is going to make a difference there. I think the lock-in effect and the social harm that comes from cutting yourself off from your friends is just too great. No matter what Facebook does to you, you will keep using their service. It's like we're like battered spouses with Facebook. So.
I think it's worth considering another reason that people probably don't realize how important security is. And I think your analysis was right. But also we have the safety in numbers feeling, which is why birds flock together and stuff. And we feel like, why would they target me? And one of the answers is that, as the security experts often point out, when you accumulate a lot of data in one place, that's a great target. And it makes it easier for the criminals to find.
Do you want to have another shot?
Oh, yeah. Do you have an idea, really, how much more processing power, hardware, or whatever would require for Google to use SSL? Because I suspect it's not really that much. Do you know on a percentage?
So it depends. Google custom builds all their computers. So they get chips directly from Intel, and they get motherboard manufacturers to make them special motherboards. And so they literally, you know, anything that isn't needed, they take it out in the design stage. Their servers are designed to do one thing, or to do, you know, a few things. Generally, when you're doing large amounts of encryption and decryption, you have special processors that you put on the computer. They're called crypto coprocessor cards. I mean, they're sort of like a video card, in that they just handle this specific math operation. I don't think that Google has any or many. I mean, it's been years since I was there. I don't think they have those. And so they would need to deploy those, or they would need to buy more of them if they don't have them already. Depending on what the numbers, I mean, the fact is that every additional customer who uses SSL there's some opportunity cost to that, right? That's some other service they cannot do because they're providing security to that non-paying customer.
There's something like Grease Monkey scripts that force Facebook to use SSL for all of its connections. Do you think those are of any, is that worth pursuing that avenue in the meantime as a patch for that kind of thing, or do you think that's a...
So my understanding, I tried this out this morning, is that Facebook offers SSL for the login portion of the session. As Grease Monkey script or anything else won't, I mean,
so
that
they don't actually serve their stuff up.
Yeah, if you try and connect to Facebook via SSL, they will kick you over to a non-encrypted session. So I don't believe that.
So the Grease Monkey script is badly advertised.
Probably. Yes.
The question on Google's Chrome incognito mode, is that really helping anything at all? And are they able to support that in a cheaper way?
I mean, if you want to look at porn, it's really good. Yeah. So the incognito mode, and so Firefox has a private browsing mode, and IE has one. I mean, what they do is they clean up your history so that you enter this mode, and then once you've left it, no one can sit down at your computer and see what you've done. That's great if someone sits down at your computer. That doesn't stop the person sitting next to you from watching the data as it goes by. So they're different problems.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm concerned about the worthwhileness of your campaign in general. I'm thinking of all the people in my neighborhood. The vast majority of them don't lock their houses, they don't lock their cars. Some of them leave their doors wide open.
Where do you live?
In Newton.
Canada.
Okay.
They leave their doors wide open, and nobody does, even though every house comes equipped with a lock, and everybody has a key, and they take it with them, they still don't do it. And that people, if they perceive that there's no threat to them, that they feel comfortable going to their Starbucks, well, just won't enable this, and that's people just won't do it.
So isn't that what you're just saying, an argument for making sure the service provider does it for them?
No, I mean,
if Google turns it on, then we don't need to depend upon these people who don't lock their houses and don't lock their bikes and don't lock their cars from having to lock their browser. Any more? Yes.
So I guess a similar point, but maybe a little bit different approach. I guess I'm not convinced that the situation of electronic documents is so much more, so dire that it's worse than, say, paper documents. I mean, to the last questioner's point, you know, there's a box on the curb where every day somebody drives by and leaves a whole bunch of important documents for me, and they're not encrypted and they're not locked, and yeah, I sort of trust that that box is reasonably secure unless there's something really important, in which case, you know, you have something that requires a signature. But even documents that require signatures to be sent back or have your social on them end up in this unsecured, unlocked box in front of your house. I don't see there being a moral panic over mailboxes, so I don't know why there would be, or I don't see a panic over the security of mailboxes, so I don't know, by the same token, why a security panic over essentially electronic documents stored can be any more.
So do you walk around with your ATM PIN number written on your forehead? No. Okay, so you observe some basic security, right?
It's in your pocket, though. I mean, in pickpockets.
Well, his PIN number isn't. His card is. I mean, yes, the mail system sucks, and some of us can avoid that by living in apartment buildings or having a locked mailbox. But the fact is that, you know, your actual account authenticators are not sent through the mail very often. So your statements might be, but your online banking password isn't. I mean, all right, okay. So.
But your bank is SSL encrypted already, and that's sort of.
Right, so your bank does that because, so the reason your bank uses SSL and Google doesn't is that if you suffer identity theft and someone withdraws $5,000 from your bank account, the bank is on the line. That's the way the law is written, right? So the bank suffers the financial harm. Google doesn't care if your account gets broken into. They are not liable for any issues, and their terms of service are, you know, 22 pages long and say that we're not responsible for anything, right? So they don't care. The worst thing that happens is maybe some loss of reputation if it becomes widespread, whereas the banks suffer a genuine financial harm. And so that's why the banks send out your ATM card 3 days after they send the PIN out, and, you know, these various other things. But what, you know, whether your documents are private or not, or whether your online spreadsheets are private or not, the fact is that your inbox is used as a backup security device for many other services. So when I forget my Facebook password, they send that reminder to my inbox. And so anyone who controls your inbox, and this is what Google says in their deeply hidden privacy warning, your inbox controls the keys to your other financial information. Right? So there is a need to protect that, and they're not doing it. 1 second.
Curiosity, what's the comparable risk when you're checking your email on a phone?
On a phone? So when you're checking your email on the phone, it's almost it's the same risk as checking your email from your Comcast connection. Actually, Comcast is a bad example. AT&T connection at your house, right? So the risk is that an engineer working for AT&T or an engineer working for Sprint will see the data as it crosses their network. Whereas when you use a public wireless network, anyone within 200 meters can see that data. So there's very little risk in checking your Gmail account or checking your Yahoo Mail account when you're at home plugged into the wall, or even using a password-protected wireless network.
What if your phone's using Wi-Fi?
If you're using Wi-Fi, then it's the same risk as a laptop. It means you're using a smaller laptop, but it's the same system.
Okay. A remark. In Europe, we've had the cigarette regulatory option as a part of law. We've had it for the last 5 years or more. Yeah. More, in fact, it hasn't made much difference. And the reason for this, but that's my speculation, is that maybe the risks are not really comparable between cigarettes, seat belts, and Gmail, because when you smoke, you put your most essential asset, your life, to a serious threat. Similar with seat belts. With Gmail, it seems pretty much different. You said yourself that no court cases have been reported, no complaints to FTC or whatever. There has been no publicity about real damage. So maybe the regulatory response, as it would be when there is a serious damage at stake and very obvious, is not really appropriate. Maybe the regulatory response should be much lighter than the regulatory response to cigarettes or to seatbelts. Sure. I don't know. Anyway, I'm sure about it is that in Europe it doesn't really work. We can talk about it later on. Sure. And I can explain you which provisions, why, and so on. But
so I agree that the analogy doesn't work 100%, right? And actually, it actually works, I think, in my favor, which is that it's really difficult to have a cigarette that doesn't kill you. But it's actually fairly easy to have an email service that isn't insecure out of the box, right? So, I mean, it's not like you can just tweak the ingredients of the cigarette and suddenly, you know, it's safe. And I think because of that, you know, people are given this choice of either, you know, smoke cigarettes and die, or don't smoke cigarettes. Whereas with the email, there's like another option, right? It's like, oh, okay, maybe I can just switch to a different brand, or maybe I can just, you know, pay 10 cents more for the email secure version.
Of course, I'm just thinking about the regulatory response. Sure. To this. Whether the regulatory response, if the risks are different, whether the regulatory response should be comparable.
And the other thing I wanted to mention is that identity theft is one of the largest growing crimes in the country. So we don't know how people are stealing account information and credit cards. Okay. I mean, we know that they're being stolen, but this is one of these crimes where, you know, there are no fingerprints that are being left behind in many cases.
But do you think, because I don't know that, do you think email is one of the sources here, or that, you know, this... That the damage which is done because the security system of email, Gmail, or whatever else, has loopholes.
I don't know. I mean, if I were criminally inclined, I suspect I would probably make a lot of money just by looting email accounts.
And not just money, but imagine your arch enemy, a really vile person who you have good reason to hate. If you had access to their inbox and all of their passwords and all of their social networking sites and their email, think of the damage you could do. Justify it.
That's why I was asking about these court cases, because at the end of the day, it would end up in a court probably. Right.
So why do we spend all this time in tweaking our Facebook? I mean, those 20% of us who do, why do we spend all this time tweaking our Facebook profile settings when any of the friends of ours who are sitting in the same cafe as us can read anything they want in our profiles? And I think that's sort of one of the things we need to focus on. Judith, did you have another one?
Wondering how much you think you would have more success with business audiences who really do feel paranoid about their documents all the time. Because, I mean, well, I don't necessarily agree with Scott, and I have had to take down a mailbox because mail was stolen out of the boxes. I mean, it does happen, maybe not in Newton, but there are places where people just don't have mailboxes because they're so insecure. But it seems that a business audience tends to be very, very paranoid about their documents, and it might seem that would be the place to get at least the demand for it and the options more in the open.
So this is a really good point, and unfortunately, the incentives are not there. So, and the reason is that most business users don't make security decisions themselves. There is a chief information officer or a chief security officer for that company who decides what products are going to be installed on which computers and what the firewall policy is and all this other stuff.
Shouldn't that make it easier? Because they should be knowledgeable.
So if you're a company and you decide to pay $50 a year per seat for Google's mail and documents, so they have a commercial version of their service, right? You as the CIO can turn on encryption for every employee with one button click, and it doesn't cost you any more for that service, right? So you, the CIO who is most educated and most informed to make this decision, can do that, and then all your other employees get to benefit from that single choice. Whereas in the consumer space, each consumer has to be their own CIO, and many are not informed or educated or able to make that decision or even aware of the risks, right? So in the business space, Microsoft has its Office Live suite, which competes with Google Docs. Business customers can have SSL if they want it, and CIOs can enable that option if they choose to pay for it, right? So this is something that can be done at the enterprise level, and it already is. So I suspect that when Vivek Quindra rolled out Google Docs across the DC enterprise, they're probably using SSL, just like Google uses SSL for its internal use of Google Mail and Google Docs and everything else. It's that consumers don't have the time or knowledge to make these choices themselves, and companies leave them with that choice. Yeah.
You seem to be saying from one side of the mouth that you're extremely unhappy with the Patriot Act that's trying to protect supposedly the public. On another hand, you want some kind of regulation that would protect us from Google and so force providers not enable and or disabling people to steal our data as easily.
So your point is that I want my cake and I want to eat it too?
Yeah.
Yes. I would like laws that protect me from evil corporations, and I object to laws that allow the government to intrude into my privacy. Amr?
So one question that's sort of coming out of the RC that maybe you could comment on is related to the comment about Google's motivation for not turning on SSL, and the comment was maybe the government has an interest in Google not being so secure, and it makes it easier for people to snoop on that way. And I mean, there's probably not hard data on it, but what...
So allow me to put my tinfoil hat on for a moment. So last year or the year before, there was this article in the Wall Street Journal where I think it was the head of DNI, which is the Director of National Intelligence, said that every year the government, with its sniffing infrastructure, collects vast amounts of email and search engine queries and instant messaging traffic and all this other stuff. We don't know how they're doing that. We don't know which telecommunications companies they're in bed with and have access and have whose networks they've been able to collect data from. But if AT&T or if Google and Yahoo and Microsoft turned on encryption by default, the government's job would be much more difficult. Now, I don't know whether the NSA has leaned on them. I suspect that Google, like, it's already in Google's best interest to make their systems or to keep the cost of their systems low by not offering security. I don't think they need the NSA leaning on them, but it's definitely a fringe benefit for the government, and I'm sure the government appreciates everything that Google is doing for our nation's safety. Any remaining questions? Do we have any more time, Amr? Is that it? Okay.
You're talking about Adobe and its Photoshop.
Express, yeah.
And that offers, doesn't it offer now a word processing suite to a cloud word processing suite?
Adobe?
Yeah.
They bought Buzzword.
Okay, but this isn't part
ubiquitous,
of
this. Yes, they do.
This isn't part of their Photoshop thing. This is like a different product, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm not aware of that tool. I don't know whether it supports SSL by default. Okay. I know that Zoho, which is another of the big word processing online providers, doesn't use encryption by default.
I think Buzzword does.
Given that they bought this product, I don't know how much they've rolled it into to sort of, you know, everything else that Adobe has. I'd need to look at it. But I mean, you know, there's nothing stopping them from turning this on. So it's just whether the business folks decided that it was worth it. Alan, do you want to get that confused look off your face?
I just want to go back to a quick question, which is unclear from my notes.
Yeah.
Are you advocating for every communication go through SSL, or are you just saying that the authentication handshake should be encrypted?
So right now, the authentication handshake is encrypted. by default.
Well, it's not when I transmitting the authentication cookie. So it's still
So the cookie goes along with everything. It's very difficult to separate the cookie from the request. So the password and username already gets encrypted. The cookie that then says hi, I'm Alan for every request. It's really difficult to divorce that from the data. I mean, I don't know how you could possibly do that. I mean, maybe there would be a way, but it would be really difficult. I think the solution is to offer SSL by I mean, there are various wish lists I have. At the very least, it should be offered. Where it's offered, it should be publicized and advertised. If a company really wants to say, make an argument that that this slows down our product, that consumers won't like it, give them the choice, but at least tell consumers that it exists. And I think, you know, the most basic step would be Google putting a secure login button on the front page of the Gmail site. You know, right now they should not be hiding this six layers deep in their help settings. And then that one option that does turn it on should be labeled maybe a little bit more clearly.
Buzzword does SSL for the data as well.
Cool. All right, so that's two of Adobe's tools that are secure out of the box. So go Adobe. All right, anything else? Oh, thank you very much.